Okay. Hello. So my name is Brett Bass. I work for Forefront Suicide Prevention. So I'm in charge of a program called Safer Homes Suicide Aware. The echo in here is crazy. I'm not used to that. I'm also a rifle and pistol marksmanship instructor for Bellevue Gun Club. And I spent the last 13 years in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve in that capacity. I was technically a military policeman. I like to say technically, because I was never assigned to the provost marshal's office, which means I have never written a speeding ticket and I have never responded to a domestic dispute, so don't blame me if you ever got pulled over aboard a military installation. I like to tell a couple of bad jokes here and there. I am generally a pretty glasses-half-full kind of a guy, so if at any point during my presentation, because the subject matter is somewhat dour, if somebody says, hey, you know, I just don't think the tone really makes sense for what we're talking about, just let me know, and I will readdress and we'll be a little more stone-faced about the whole thing. So I like to open with a bad joke. That way, even if my presentation just bombs terribly, at least you've heard something worse, right? So does anyone know why their nose is not 12 inches long? Because it would be a foot. You guys have heard that one before. Oh, man. You've heard that one before. Well, let's see. So I went to the zoo the other day. You're going to appreciate this. I went to the zoo. I was hoping to see exotic animals. But when I walked in, the first enclosure had nothing in it except for a rock in the middle of it with a French baguette sitting on the rock. So I grabbed the zookeeper. I was like, hey, man, I want to see lions and tigers and bears, but you have baked goods in here. I don't get it. He says, don't worry about it, sir. It's okay. It's bred in captivity. Okay. Got some good groans and everything. All right. This is going to be a little bit unorthodox. Yeah. Don't worry. I am all the time. Is there a possible way I can get the PowerPoint presentation to be displayed on one or both of the screens? Would that be? Outstanding. That's totally fine. All or nothing makes sense to me. Great. So, Forefront Suicide Prevention is a center for excellence at the University of Washington in the School of Social Work. So, what does that mean? A center for excellence is essentially an apparatus of the university that doesn't have a direct educational outreach program, so we're just on social issues. So, we focus on systems change, we have some legislative action that we have been responsible for, and then we have a number of programs, and mine is one of them. So, the Safer Homes program kind of spurred out of our center director making a cold call to the National Rifle Association. So Dr. Jen Stuber, who was supposed to be here, but due to a comical series of mishaps, I wound up getting here like a day late, and she didn't wind up making it at all. But suffice to say, she lost her husband to suicide several years ago. And sort of in her path to look for answers, she called the NRA. She herself wasn't a gun owner, and said, well, what is it that the NRA is doing? She learned two key things. The first thing is that even gun owners, I know, a shocker, suffer terrible losses as a result of suicide. And the gun community didn't necessarily have a very good idea about what to do. And that sort of spurred her into a partnership with Alan Gottlieb, who you all know. And the end result of that was the Safer Homes program. So in 2016, the state legislature in Washington, where I live, created a suicide prevention task force called Safer Homes Suicide Aware. And the co-chairs of that task force are Alan Gottlieb and Dr. Jen Stuber, who's in charge of Forefront. So our program focuses on key outreach to communities with high rates of firearms ownership. In a few ways, demographically, we, as people that own firearms, actually fall into one of the most at-risk groups of people who might be in danger of a suicidal crisis. And, of course, we have access to lethal means. So the outreach that we do is controversial, particularly within the University of Washington system. We're not allowed to advertise the work that we do. We're most famous for our work in gun shows, so we go where people are, and they rely on key people like Alan or me to be able to be trusted messengers to a community with, shall we say, a high degree of skepticism about government programs. So Safer Homes is at least partially funded by the state legislature. So some of the funding that provides all the cool swag, which I'm going to talk about, which is available if you guys want any of it, comes from them. But our principal corporate sponsor is the Boeing company. So every time I have to fly on an Airbus airplane, I always roll my eyes and just put up with it. But it's fine. You guys are good. I like the fact you're laughing at everything. That makes my job a little bit easier. So we can advance the slide there. That's our mission. Again, systems change, empowering individuals to make better choices. The presentation I'm going to be giving to you guys is the 90-minute learn training that we do. And the Boeing company has specifically funded the work that I do with an explicit emphasis on veterans issues. So a couple surprising things. One, the state of Washington has its own state-level Department of Veterans Affairs. This department brought to you by the Department of Redundancy Department. You guys are totally into it. I dig this. So the other thing that was surprising for me to learn was, in addition to that department existing, it did not have a suicide prevention capability at all. So I have provided a large number of these trainings directly to the Department of Veterans Affairs through an organization known as the Peer Corps. They have a peer-related counseling program so that people can be better trained in identifying warning signs, active listening, various types of emotional and peer-to-peer support, and I provide the suicide prevention training to that organization. And so I'm going to be giving you guys that presentation as well. So some of the terminology on the slides is geared specifically toward a veteran audience, but the basic key core tenets sort of translate over. So this is what's called a gatekeeper training. So the idea is we're going to train lay people just like you and I, folks that don't necessarily have clinical backgrounds, in how to identify warning signs and then take proactive steps to help people that might be at risk. So does that make sense? Pretty good. If we advance the slide, okay, we can see there that we have the ground rules. We have an evaluation at the end of this. My supervisor will be most upset with me if I don't ask you guys to complete that evaluation to see if I just bombed this whole thing terribly. So please do so if you have the time. There'll be a QR code. You can do it from your phone. There's no additional paperwork that you need to do. And just participate your own degree of comfort. Typically, we have a role play toward the end, so you can rehearse the steps that we've taught you, but we're a little bit compact for time, and I was instructed I needed to combine the other programmatic thing that I was doing, and that is the Safe Rooms giveaway. So when we go to community settings, again, most famously gun shows, the best way you can get somebody to come talk to you about suicide prevention is by offering some cool stuff, right? Because if you say, hey, you want to have a really frank conversation about suicide risk, yeah, it's a little bit tough. So we offer free equipment that can potentially help people and offers value to the consumer. So I have a number of things that we're giving away. I have examples of these up here on the podium with me. So I have gun safes. I have a Liberty HD50 for handguns. I have locks for tube-fed shotguns and for AR pattern rifles. They're made by a company called MSE International, and it's essentially a polycarbonate clamshell that encloses the action. It's called a life jacket, sort of their marketing nomenclature. And I also have a lockbox for prescription or over-the-counter medications. It looks kind of like a lunchbox without a handle on it, but it does have a combination lock, so even if you don't have medications, if you want to have the most secure sandwich, you can do that. And I also have a medication disposal pouch. So if you have old, unused medicine, you don't know how to dispose of it, I have a method that you can dispose of those things without it winding up in the water table or anything like that. In the state of Washington, we have a system by which pharmacies and most law enforcement agencies can dispose of unused medications, and I'm not sure if that system is translated out to other states or not, but I have all these, they're at no cost. The only thing that we have to have you do is complete a survey. It is confidential, and if you super duper extra mega don't want to do my survey, you'll break my heart. It's okay. But I do have to have you complete a liability release that says you're not going to sue me or the Safer Homes program. So if you lock your hand in the gun safe, that's not my fault. Please don't sue me. So the two documents are right here in the big, really dilapidated box that everything got shipped in over here. I have examples of these. The survey is a single page. It can ask you some questions like, hey, do you own any firearms? Do you have any medication? How do you store them? What do you know about suicide? It is confidential. Your name does not go on this document. And then the second page is the liability release itself. And this is, again, saying you're not going to sue me. We ask if we can have permission to recontact you in the future. It's totally voluntary. You don't have to be contacted by us ever again if you don't want to, but it does help our program tremendously. Right now, our partners with the Harborview Injury Prevention Research Center are doing a formal evaluation of our work, and I can share some of the preliminary data about that with you guys. But the only way we know our program works or doesn't is if we can measure what you were doing before our intervention and then what you're doing after it to see, for example, if you're using the equipment that we gave you, things of that nature. So it does help tremendously, but if you don't want to do it, this is America. It is a free country, and you don't have to. So does that kind of sort of make sense to you guys? Okay. As I'm doing the presentation, because I'm trying to combine both of these efforts at once, if somebody would be willing to pass that big awkward box around so anyone that wanted to do the paperwork could, that would be tremendously useful. Even if you don't want to do the survey, I do have to have one affiliated with your waiver, because otherwise the research scientists say, like, why isn't there a waiver or why isn't there a survey? So just write didn't complete if you're into that. So, Cool. All right. Because of 13 years in the Marines, I have a long-standing institutional loathing of PowerPoint. So slides such as this one that explain the slides, I find just real interesting. So this is what we're going to be doing. We can advance to the next one, please. So here's sort of why this matters. There was a presenter earlier talking about how emotions regulate our actions far more than knowledge does. But I find that a lot of the knowledge surrounding this topic is somewhat shocking. One of the things that's good, I actually just read this today, the CDC has revised their statistics, and we can see that we have started reversing the trend on veteran suicide. At one point during the high watermark of a really terrible uptick in veteran-related suicides, there were around 22 veterans of the armed forces of the United States on a daily basis that were taking their own lives. This says 20, and CDC numbers that I just saw have us down to about 17. So if we're going to try to draw a hopeful thing, again, I'm a glass half full kind of a guy. If we're trying to find a silver lining to this, is that we can say that when we put a lot of effort and a lot of time into something, we can start reversing these trends. So if you're looking at the demographics, the people who are at the highest risk are going to be white and or Native American men in the middle years. That's between the ages of 35 and 64. And when I'm doing a slightly modified version of this presentation in one of the classes I teach at Bellevue Gun Club, I explain the demographics of this and then tell everyone to look around the room. It's describing our community, you know, that the people that own firearms are typically wealthy enough to do so, which means they're usually not brand new to the thing. A lot of us that are physically here that are able to do this are men in the middle years. So this definitely affects the community. You know, I care about this for my own personal reasons, and I think I've shared about as much as that I care to if you saw me the other day. But a big chunk of why I care about this is because our community is in danger. Like, our people are dying. And we have to do more to reverse the trend. And as I mentioned the other day, suicide prevention has to be a gun rights issue, because anytime any one of these 47,000 people that loses their lives does so because they've chosen to shoot themselves is used against us. Right? We have to do a better job about doing this, and I think that there are things that we can do, and I think that we have pre-existing models for success. We can advance to the next slide. This is Washington State-specific information, so it's a little bit less applicable to this audience, but you can see some of the other things up there. Second leading cause of death for young people. Move the mic. I'm going to move it toward me. I'm really up in this mic right now. One of the other things that's really sort of astonishing is that suicide is now the eighth leading cause of death in Washington State. It's in the top ten. That makes it competitive with heart disease. I was shocked when I learned this. This is a topic we don't really talk about. As a result, a lot of the statistics and the information about it are probably more shocking than we would prefer. Washington doesn't particularly have a strong criminal violence issue. And if you look, the firearm-involved fatalities are almost 80% suicides. I think currently it's closer to about three-quarters, slightly more than that. And one of the reasons I like to highlight this is because you've all heard the phrase gun violence before, correct? Does anyone know what gun violence is? Anytime anyone, for any reason, is shot with any gun anywhere, that's not a very useful bucket to put things into. Because criminological issues, reducing criminal violence, this is responses that we have to reducing acts of negligence, and then suicide reductions are all very different topics. And so if somebody decides they want to engage in a conversation with you about gun violence, you say, wonderful, what are you doing about suicide prevention? Because if you're ignoring the fact that, in at least in my state, over three-quarters of the firearm-involved fatalities are suicides, they are probably wasting your time, and they probably have an agenda. And if the agenda isn't saving people's lives, you can kind of guess the direction they're skewing it, right? Nationally, it's somewhere in the ballpark about 2 out of 3 firearm-involved fatalities are from self-inflicted gunshot. There's some interesting data. The NPR folks have done a very long longitudinal study for about 2 or 3 years now, and the results of that are going to be published soon. But in polling just regular average Americans about what they think the largest causes of gun deaths are, the number one, they say it's homicides, and then following that, they say that it is mass shootings. And I have found the work that I do, depending on the type of audience that I'm presenting this information to, and principally it's to groups like the Washington Department of Veterans Affairs Peer Corps. But if I'm, for example, talking to public health people are intelligent, well-intentioned, everything, but they don't really track firearms specifically. And as a result, if I ask them informally, what do you think the largest cause of firearm-involved death is, they typically say mass shootings because they're very sensationalized. They're in the news a lot. If I ask a professional audience, so if I'm doing this for a police agency or for members of the armed forces, we just did an event on Naval Station Everett for the U.S. Coast Guard, which is great, they typically say it's accidents. And I'm of the opinion that there's probably a degree of sort of professional hubris that goes along with this. Having both trained police officers in marksmanship at my facility and having managed the range at which they shot, I can tell you that a large number of the people that carry guns professionally are not necessarily enthusiastic or proficient. And so a disproportionate number of the negligent discharges that have happened at my range have sadly been from law enforcement officers. But because they've received formal training, it's mandatory. I think they have sort of an inflated sense of what that is. So they tend to ascribe negligence to these things. And if I ask generic gun owners, what do you think the largest cause of gun death is? I often hear criminal violence, inner city gang violence, things of that nature. And the reason this is worth sort of getting didactic and talking about the statistics is if we don't diagnose the problem correctly, we're never going to get the right solution. And the area where we have common ground here with folks that aren't necessarily gun people, that aren't going to show up at a conference like this, might be ambivalent or even actively hostile to some of the things that we hold near and dear about gun rights, the thing we have in common is we want to reduce unnecessary deaths. And if we want to reduce suicides, we have to talk about guns. And if we're going to talk about guns, we have to talk about suicides. Right? So we can move to the next one of these slides. It'd be great. This is more information that's veteran specific. Again, this is the program that we have for the Washington State Department of Veterans Affairs. Some of these are kind of sobering. Suicide risk being slightly more than twice as high for people who've served in the armed forces of our great republic. A large percentage of the veterans that take their own lives are not seeking and have not sought health care through the Department of Veterans Affairs, the federal one. Instinctively, part of me is like, yeah, I kind of get that. Has anyone here used the VA system? Yeah. How awesome was it? If you can't hear on the microphone, there are people actually laughing right now, right? I will say that simply in my time using the VA, for my health care, I have noticed significant improvements, but there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. So a high degree of skepticism, again, isn't shocking. The last part over there, well, this is actually the second one in the middle, double the risk. We find that there are commonalities between a number of professions that seem like they don't have anything in common. So when I tell you that some of the professions at elevated risk for suicide include first responders. People kind of nod along with that, like, okay, yeah, they have easy access to firearms, an extremely stressful job, divorce rates are high, et cetera. I get that. Members of the armed forces, okay, yeah, I get that too. Veterans, people generally nod along. But then I say veterinarians. And people start like, what? Well, veterinarians have a very stressful job. If you had to put down animals on a regular basis and you're in a fairly insular community that has a very long training pipeline, and you have access to lethal means, in this case medications in their community. This is also true for physicians, for dentists, for attorneys, right? So if you look at some of the commonalities there, long training pipeline, insular community, so it's hard to reach out. Some of that also applies to us. I live in a place called Edmonds, which is a suburb of Seattle and what I like to refer to as the free county of Snohomish. I moved out of Seattle because I couldn't quite take it anymore. It was just too many people and too expensive. But it's still definitely an area with a relatively low rate of firearms ownership. I think the statewide average for Washington is it's around the national average, 30-40%. In heavily urbanized areas, though, it's probably closer to 10. And so if you're a member of our community in an area in which it's kind of hard to get to know your neighbors because you're afraid they're going to, I don't know, dime you out with a red flag law or whatever, it can be kind of hard to understand that you do need to reach out to other people for help, right? This is also true in the veteran community. The last slide over there, not slide, but the last bubble over there about the rate for veteran suicide amongst women going up by so much. I think there's a little bit of a strong correlation here because that number starts in 2001 and combat operations for the global war on terrorism began that year. So the rate of women that are joining has been increasing. The number of them that have been seeing direct combat has been significantly increasing. So that last one is shocking, but it shouldn't be surprising. All right, next slide, please. When it comes to the means that veterans choose to end their lives, it is disproportionately self-inflicted gunshot. There are a number of theories about why this is, part of it being access. The rate with which veterans of the armed forces own personal firearms is higher than the national average. The best sort of scientific studies on this say it's about half. And I'm of the opinion that there probably is some degree of underreporting with that as well, but it's at least 10% higher than the studies for generic Americans, so there's a higher degree of access, higher degree of familiarization with such things. If you look at, for example, the dentists, the doctors, and the veterinarians, they typically choose poisoning as the means to end their own lives. And because they have a greater knowledge of how medicines can be used inappropriately, the fatality rate is higher than for regular people that decide they want to down a bottle of ibuprofen. Which is agonizing, but rarely fatal, right? And again, going back to the idea about men in the middle years, you know, more than half of all of them are men 55 years and up. Next slide, please. It's a very slow slide. There we go. We used to have kind of like a game show version of this, like pick the one of these boxes that is true, and it's like bait and switch, they're all accurate. So anymore, we just like to display the information. You know, suicide affects everybody. There are huge ripple effects from when there's a very close personal loss, right? One of the upper corner there about asking about suicide, there's sort of a pernicious myth that I don't want to ask anybody about it because I don't want to put it in anybody's head. And none of the sociological data that we have actually supports that. In a number of cases, like you ask somebody, like, have you been thinking about killing yourself? And they just break down and start crying right then and there. That's a pretty good indicator that you kind of hit a raw nerve, right? The idea that I don't want to say anything because I don't want to put the idea in somebody's head is something we need to put to bed. Granted, that we've been seeing less and less of that as of late, which is a good thing because it gets us more in the mindset of, like, I can intervene and I should intervene, which is what we like to see. The bottom one there says many suicides are preventable is phrasing that we are very deliberate about. My organization isn't going to say that every suicide is preventable. We're not going to say that most of them are, but we think that many can be. And sort of what we're going to do with this training is at least try to prepare you so that if you encounter somebody you're worried about, you'll be better able to articulate why it is that you're worried and more confident in trying to connect that person to helping services. Right? The other one is multiple complex factors. There's sort of another pernicious myth out there that a bad thing happened and somebody chose to kill themselves. And there may be some instances in which a singular bad thing happening was like, that was it. But generally speaking, what we see is there's one particularly evocative moment, but this is at the top of an iceberg of all sorts of other things. It's very rarely somebody winds up with a sleep disorder, so they choose to kill themselves. It's generally somebody develops a sleep disorder because they've been going through a divorce, because their job has been on the rocks, and because of this and that, and it winds up an accumulating thing. Does that make sense? Next slide, please. There we go. And this is it. People regularly ask me, why is the suicide problem getting so much worse? And the simple answer that's not very satisfying is because we are not inculcating a society of people that are resilient to stress. When somebody's ability to cope has been exceeded by whatever it is with which they are coping, it places them at risk. And so, again, it doesn't have to be one really big event. It can be an aggregation of a whole bunch of other things. Some of them could be deeply traumatic. Some of them could seem mundane to the rest of us. But if you don't have the ability and the knowledge to cope with it, and you don't know what else to do, it can kind of put it on your radar, right? Next slide, please. Nice filler slide right there. We can continue. We like to say that suicide prevention should be viewed as a leadership trait. Part of this is packaging. Like, for how many of you have served in the armed forces of the United States? A whole bunch of you. Thank you, by the way. For those of you that were at least somewhat recently in the armed forces, how many safety stand downs did you have to sit through in which a PowerPoint presentation about like don't kill yourself was on the thing? And it's like some like 20-year-old Lance Corporal who's possibly hungover from like the night before that's just like clicking through a slide, like looking directly at it, reading it verbatim, and then like looking back at you and like sweating. That's kind of how it goes in the armed forces. The presentations, hey, it's great that you're trying to inculcate like public speaking abilities amongst your junior leaders, but the quality of the presentation typically isn't all that great, and as a result, everybody hates it. So as we're trying to package this to veteran and military communities, we're saying this is, as a leader, something that you should be proficient within. There are 14 U.S. Marine Corps leadership traits. The acronym is JJ Did Tie Buckle, and if you know what that means, then we can be friends and we can hang out later, right? But all of these tie into a number of key things, and being just and using good judgment, for example. If you're incapable of using your judgment to identify subordinates who might be at risk, this is an area that you need to seek self-improvement, right? So that's kind of why we package it that way. A close personal friend of mine is the best man at his wedding. He's in zone for lieutenant colonel because he stayed in as opposed to me. I wanted to get a really great beard, and I wouldn't describe it as great, but I'm working on it. So anyway, one of our mutual, very close friends this last June wound up in like a really profound crisis. And it was 5-alarm, like rollout, all the support that we could muster. And he's fine today. He's trying to reconcile a lot of things, but he made it. He got it through crisis. Most people tend to. But in talking with my friend who's in zone for lieutenant colonel, even though he's led Marines in the Middle East on multiple occasions, been doing this since 2005 was when he commissioned, he said, like, legitimately, I didn't know what to do. And it's one thing to get that PowerPoint presentation from the sweaty 20-year-old Lance Corporal. It's another thing to actually develop any skills. So, next slide over. This is LEARN. This is the acronym. You guys have those little yellow cards that I was trying to pass out, and I was deeply grateful for everybody else to assist. Thank you so much for passing those out. This is our acronym for suicide prevention. Are you guys familiar with, like, ASSIST or QPR? Excellent. At least one of you is. This is sort of our equivalent to that. And since I work for Forefront and we came up with it, I'm biased. We think ours is the best, right? So the L step in this is look for warning signs. So before we click to the next slide, it's kind of hard to get audience engagement in this particular setting, but are there specific things that you guys would think of as a potential warning sign? How many of you, for example, I saw a hand come up, because the microphone can't get really passed around easily, we'll kind of do a different format here. If you want to, like, mention something, is this microphone working up here? All the microphones are working, so if you want to mention a potential warning sign, feel free to come up and use the mic. That one's working too. That one's working as well. We all sorts of them. In the back, we heard depression, right? Change of behavior. Well, you've done this before, my friend, right? Yes, sir. See, we're told they're all working, but they're not. That one should be working.
You notice people giving things away that they normally are very personal to themselves, and they're distributing them, giving them away as over a period of time.
Yeah.
You kind of see that accumulation.
Giving away of prized possessions. That's one that many people are very well knowledgeable about. Yes, sir. Got a hand coming up.
Extreme frustration.
Extreme frustration. Yeah. Any number of things. Let's click to the next slide, see how many of these guys nailed. All sorts of things, right? Loneliness, helplessness, frustration, anger, irritability. These are all sorts of feelings that you might observe in somebody. Again, being down in the dumps all the time. I mean, because depression is technically a clinical diagnosis, I was diagnosed as clinically depressed in 2013 after I got back from Afghanistan. We try to be a little bit more loath and careful about how we use that term. It's kind of like assault rifle has a very specific technical definition that we all try to be respectful of within the community. So we try to reciprocate when it comes to the mental health folks, too. But that same basic idea, yeah, absolutely. What about if we click to the next slide here? Actions, things that people are doing, not just necessarily emotions they're experiencing. Giving away of the prized possessions right over there. An interesting study came out of the Humane Society of California, and a stronger correlation is people giving their pets away, right? Because if one of your friends, for example, says, hey, could you take care of my dog? It's a great dog. You're like, oh yeah, what's going on? He's like, I'm going away for a while. How long? A while. That might be something to set off your spidey senses, right? Various things to look for. Sleeping, either too much or not at all. So if somebody reveals to you, like, hey, this is one more thing I need to potentially be worried about, right? Let's move to the next slide here. Before we do that, the top of that said withdrawal and isolation, and that resonates very much with me. I now know, after seeing a number of mental health professionals over the years, when I start downward spiraling, I self-isolate. I don't want to drag other people down with me, right? And now, because I have gone to counseling, I've gone to therapy, I now recognize that, and I can take proactive steps to avoid it. So hopefully that's empowering you guys, too. Within this community specifically, there's a huge amount of distrust. Like, if I go see somebody, I'm going to lose my gun rights. And in the majority of instances, that's absolutely not true. Is anyone here from New Jersey? In New Jersey, it kind of is accurate. And outside of New Jersey, it's not, though. In the state of Washington, when I'm teaching these classes, I routinely have students say, I don't want to go talk to a mental health professional because I don't want to lose my gun rights. And the state of Washington mostly defers to federal law on these things. So for a mental health problem to deprive you of your constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms, you have to be adjudicated as mentally defective or involuntarily committed, like the dudes with the butterfly nets came after you, right? Talking to a counselor does not deprive you of your gun rights, except kind of in New Jersey where it kind of does. But outside of the state of New Jersey, that's generally speaking not the case. Yes, ma'am? Yeah, so the comment was that in schools, many people sign waivers in which if it's disclosed that there's suicidal ideation or attempt, homicide, et cetera, the person, like the counselor, is a mandatory reporter. And is there more question behind that as well? Sure. So typically when somebody who's a mandatory reporter gets something along those lines, say, like, I had a client that said, like, in session, this person said, like, I tried to kill myself. And they then have to refer that to somebody else. Alternatively, it's like my client said, like, straight up, I'm going to murder Joe Blow. Yeah, they kind of have to let somebody know about that. And there's typically an evaluative process that goes behind that. A lot of it's somewhat technical, but it rarely results in arrest, and it rarely results in involuntary committal. The most common type of a worst-case scenario could be a 72-hour hold in which your provider thinks, like, this person's, like, imminent risk of self-harm, and they might like hold you for 72 hours. In my state, in Washington, means you cannot purchase firearms for a period of 6 months following that. But in many other states, those policies can differ. So again, unless you've been committed to a psychiatric institution, or you've sat before a judge and basically pled not guilty by reason of criminal insanity, you're not going to lose your gun rights in the majority of jurisdictions. Confidentiality? Yeah. And that's great. But and for the purposes of the recording, essentially the gentleman in the audience pointed out that when a counselor does receive a mandatory report, they report it to a licensed mental health professional such as a psychiatrist, and what you discuss with that psychiatrist is protected by doctor-patient confidentiality. So, anyway, verbal or written signs, if somebody says, like, I'm thinking about killing myself, which you kind of have to take it seriously. I find a strange amount of overlap between my two lines of work, between talking about suicide prevention and talking about active shooter preparedness and response. If you see something, say something. I'm old enough to remember when that was like a big deal. And the same thing also applies for taking care of each other, right? So if you see somebody post something on social media, there's actually a couple of really interesting things. Like Facebook and Instagram have a lot of really kind of big brotherish tendencies, which might be a little bit weird. But they're not all bad, just like the majority of us. I try not to be all bad as well. I'm wearing a black shirt, but I try not to be a villain in most circumstances, right? So if you see something specifically on Facebook, Instagram, and you're like, oh boy, I am really worried about the person that said this, you can flag it, not as this is inappropriate and offensive and I'm triggered, but you can flag it as I'm worried about my friend that said this thing. And the next time they log into the platform, they'll get a message with the suicide crisis hotline number on it says something like, hey, your friends expressed that they were worried about you, and we just want to check in and make sure everything's okay. That's kind of cool, right? Anyone ever see anything on social media in which one of your friends posts like nothing but like one isolated song lyric? Yeah. That always is a big red flag for me, too. Because like if somebody's saying something and they're vague about it and you haven't heard from them in a while, definitely something I always worry about. I try to always make sure I text the person after I see something like it just to follow up, right? Next slide, please. Didn't work. Okay. Let's go back. So next we're going to empathize and listen. I have discovered in my time working at Forefront, apparently empathy is not something that comes naturally to me. As it turns out, I'm sympathetic. I sympathize very well, but I don't necessarily empathize. And if I had been asked point blank, what's the difference between those two ideas prior to my working for the organization, I really wouldn't have been able to tell you. And typically we have this great video by Brené Brown, which can explain the difference between empathy and sympathy. If you just click to the next one, it should autoplay. It's really super duper supposed to. This is heartbreaking. Well, I'm going to tell you what. In the interest of speed, I'll attempt to summarize. So, empathy is the act of allowing somebody to share something with you and you being open to it, non-judgmental. Sympathy is the act of feeling bad for somebody. So, empathy is allowing someone to tell you what's going on with their life and you not necessarily trying to fix all of their problems. Because in a position in which, I'm assuming a large chunk of you guys are married, right? If your spouse comes up to you and starts talking about their bad day, and you start saying, well, you gotta fix this and that and talk to this guy and everything, does that work real well? No. I have discovered that it is often wise to begin with, is this a listening conversation or is this a solutions conversation, right? Solutions is sympathy. I feel bad for that, and as a result, I want to provide a solution. But what it actually tells the person that has entrusted you enough to start talking about something profoundly vulnerable, right? If you said, like, hey, Pat, like, I'm really worried about you because of X, Y, and Z that I observe in your behavior, and they start talking about it, and you're like, well, you really ought to just fix that in your life and do one of these. What they are hearing is, I want to find ways to get you to not talk to me about this anymore. That's what they're perceiving, right? And as a community of people that we're typically kind of a little bit isolationist sometimes, in the event you choose to open up to somebody and they start just saying, well, if you fix this and you do that, it's like, well, why? I wasted my time, right? So learn how to empathize with somebody. Learn how to hear what they're saying and just allow them to offload some of it. Because the moral of the story at the end of the video is really beautiful. Brené Brown basically says something along the lines of, solutions, believe it or not, don't really solve people's problems very often, but it's connection with other people that can. Right? So does that kind of sort of make sense about empathy? Are you guys familiar with the concept of active listening? Yeah, so for those of you that aren't, active listening is sort of the idea that as somebody talks to you, you can repeat back to them some of what they have said to you. So, for example, what's your name, sir? His name's Mark. Mark, what did you have for breakfast today? Mark didn't. I also didn't have breakfast today, Mark. Did you get to have lunch? I also haven't gotten to have lunch. But you'll note, I repeated back what he was said to me. And Mark, at any point in that conversation, did you feel as though I didn't know what you were saying, that I wasn't listening to you? Right? Very small, kind of half-assed, kind of funny version of that. But that's kind of how active listening works. And you can show somebody empathy and show that you're paying attention to them by asking them questions that reflect back part of what they're saying to you. So somebody's like, you know, I'm really struggling a lot. You know, my marriage is really on the rocks right now. Like, oh man, it sounds like you're having some really serious trouble with your marriage. Like, do you want to talk about that? You mirror back some of what they've said, allow them more opportunities to offload things to you, right? It's a good way to show some empathy. You can go to the next slide because this one disappointed me, right? Here's an example. Somebody says, why bother? It's all so pointless. What is something you could say to show this person some empathy? The last three words they said? It's so pointless? Oh. Ah, okay. So you could sort of say, like, it's all pointless. Like, really? And sort of invite them to talk to you about it? That's good, yeah. Yeah, so ask them to tell you more, see what's going on, sort of solicit a little more feedback from them, right? Just knowledge that somebody cares enough to listen to you sometimes helps. Maybe not a lot, maybe not immediately, but I think in aggregate it can. Absolutely. All right, let's move to the next one. A, asking about suicide. So what we like to tell people to do is be as direct as possible and avoid euphemism. Avoid vague language, right? If I ask somebody, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Is that the same question as, are you considering suicide? No. What if I say, are you thinking about doing something stupid? Yeah, that one hits a little bit close to I like that one hits a little bit close to home for me. The friend of mine that I mentioned in June that was really, really, really up the edge of the cliff, so to speak, last year at one point called me up. We were in the Marines together. He wanted a career in civilian law enforcement, and then he decided he wanted to be able to provide better for his family, so he made a move literally and physically from rural Idaho to Puyallup, Washington, which is in the south of the Puget Sound area near Seattle, and went into commercial insurance sales. And at one point he called me, and I could hear he was really not doing well, and he said, wouldn't it be hypothetically really great if my life insurance policy kicked in so my wife and my kid would be taken care of? I said, Mike, do I need to hold on to your guns? For him, he thought the whole thing out. It wasn't stupid. It made perfect sense to him. It was wrong. But it wasn't stupid. And as we talked about earlier, people who are experiencing suicidality, they're in the midst of a crisis, there's sort of a hypnotic effect to it. They can't cope with this mountain of things they're dealing with. And suicide inserts itself as a way to escape the pain of what they're going through and as a potential solution. And very few people that become suicidal actively want to die. Most of them want to stop suffering. If you ask somebody, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Like, no, I don't want to hurt anymore at all, is the thought they have. And they don't know how else to get there. So when you ask, we want you to ask directly. We can go to the next slide. And that sort of reinforces it. Are you thinking about killing yourself? Have you considered suicide? Right? I'm sort of a pedant for technical accuracy. At one point, I put together a presentation for the House Judiciary Committee of Washington State discussing the various types of firearms and everything. And I could tell their eyes were glazing over as all the technicalities, talking about the National Firearms Act of 1934 and GCA and all the technical differences. And I think our community values this, right? If somebody appears on television talking about assault rifles, we can almost guarantee they are not actually talking about assault rifles, right? Because that technical detail matters to us, because we care about what the statute says. We care about what the technical definitions are. We should also care about the specificity that goes along with talking about mental health problems like this. And that's why we encourage people, ask directly about suicide. Don't beat around the bush, go straight for the jugular, right? Next slide, please. Here's a little example of that active listening that I mentioned there. Right? You've observed some serious warning signs with somebody. Like, okay, in aggregate, each individual one of these things might not be that big a deal, but this guy isn't sleeping, his marriage is in trouble, he just got fired from his job, etc. You can couch it as, hey, friend, which is like a really normal way that everyone opens a conversation. So it sounds like you're having trouble sleeping, and I know you just got fired from your job and your marriage is on the rocks right now. And sometimes when people experience those things, they don't know what else to do. They consider suicide. Is that something that's occurred to you? So this is a way to combine some of the act of listening with the act of asking directly. Right? Does that make sense? Does that help you guys? Kind of prepare you a little bit better? Great. Let's move to the next slide there. This is another one of the key things here about when do you ask. And we have these bullet points about, like, there's multiple signs and there's this and that. The only one of these things that I care about is if your gut tells you. That's the only one that I care about. You may not be able to articulate it very well, but if your gut is telling you, I should be worried about this person, there is a reason for it. And if you choose to ignore that, you are doing so at, I'd say, your own peril, but really at their peril, right? And if you're worried about, like, upsetting somebody who's already doing poorly, I contend that it is better to have a slightly more upset friend than a dead one. That's my contention. One of the things that I like to use as an example is, again, the strange crossover between my two lines of work. In the San Bernardino terrorist attack, the mass shooting that took place in California a few years ago, they interviewed most of the co-workers, friends, neighbors, everything of the perpetrator's attack, and almost all of them said that for like huge spans of time, all of them had seen multiple warning signs, and they were deeply worried at some point or another, and all of them chose not to say anything. If your gut tells you, you have to pay attention to it, because again, you may not be able to articulate it, and that's fine as long as you can still take action. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. We can go to the next slide. If somebody tells you, yes, I've been considering suicide, but I've been thinking about ending my life. First, you do have to take it seriously. It's just like a bomb threat, right? You have to take them all seriously. There are gradations of seriousness, though. Like, for example, if I say, yeah, I've been thinking about it, and you ask, have you thought about how you might do it? The more specific that plan is, the further along it is, right? So if somebody says, like, you know, I just sort of thought vaguely I'd be better off if I didn't wake up tomorrow. Still not good, but it's much less refined than at noon tomorrow I'm going to go out into the field behind the house where I was raised and I'm going to hang myself with this specific rope. Then your next question, hey, do you have that specific rope? Do you have it? Right? And so these are ways you can sort of find to like ask more questions to determine the significance of how severe the crisis is for that person. The more specific, the worse they are. Yes, ma'am? Ooh, that's an interesting question. The question was, at what point and or should you attempt to talk somebody out of a physician-assisted suicide? That is a can of worms. That is a big can of worms. I don't know that I brought an opener big enough for that one. Physician-assisted suicide is contentious, and I am not really prepared to go into that, but it's an excellent question. I'll make sure you get my contact information. I'll see if my organization takes any position on that. I'm not sure. Yeah. So, anyway, if they say yes, again, I like to thank them for their honesty, acknowledge their pain. In the event somebody shared that with you, again, that's about as vulnerable as you could possibly be with somebody. And so recognizing that, I think, is valuable. What if they say no? Let's move to the next slide. That is not the slide I was expecting. Okay, well, we'll spitball this a little bit. If they say no, all right, we're going to go back to the empathy idea. If you ask, hey, you know, you're not sleeping, you just got fired from your job, your marriage on the rocks, have you been thinking about killing yourself? Sometimes people in those similar circumstances think about that too. And they're like, you know, I haven't been. This is not your excuse and your opportunity. Like, oh man, that's great. Okay. You know, there's not a lot of empathy along that, right? Again, I encourage you to get people thinking about that a little bit more detail. So you're like, oh man, I'm really glad to hear that. I'm really sorry you're still down the dumps. But in the event you did start thinking about taking your own life, would you trust me enough to tell me? Or maybe this isn't like a close friend. Maybe this isn't a family. Maybe this is like a colleague. This is, you know, a work buddy, and you have coffee and talk about how weird your boss is or something, right? Maybe you're not the person they would talk to. But maybe invite them, like, is there somebody else, or do you know who you would talk to? At least try to get them thinking about what they would do in an emergency. Right? It's the same idea that we try to pass off in the entry-level handgun classes we teach. I seriously doubt any of you guys took a class from me since this is Arizona and I live in the opposite corner of the country and everything. But we tell everybody in entry-level handgun, the most important thing that everyone needs for home defense, whether or not you even own a gun, you gotta have a plan. You have to have a plan. Like, you guys have fire plans, right? Okay, that's a very low response rate. So hopefully, when you're done with this presentation and you get some cool free stuff and whatnot, you can go home, you have dinner, be like, hey, if the house catches on fire, maybe we ought to talk about what we ought to do, right? I use the fire plan analogy very deliberately because we've had mandatory fire drills in all public and private schools in the United States of America for decades. And since we instituted them, do you know that not a single child has died in a school fire? Right? If you have a plan and you can rehearse it, the odds of succeeding under stress go way up. And the time to start thinking about what you're going to do if you or somebody else close to you winds up in a suicidal crisis, the time to figure out what to do is before the crisis. Like, if a bad guy kicks in your front door and he and his three friends are going to light you on fire and kick your dog, the time to figure out how to prevent them from lighting you on fire and kicking your dog is well before they've kicked the door in. You have to have a plan ahead of time. So when you're asking somebody, even if they say no, try to plant the seed in their mind so they can start doing some planning. Does that seem reasonable? Does that make sense to you guys? Okay. So if we're moving to the R steps, is remove the danger. I think it's a little bit hyperbolic. I prefer to say reduce access to lethal means. I don't think it's a controversial statement to say that somebody who is in the midst of a suicidal crisis, that person probably shouldn't be left unattended in a room full of loaded guns, knives, and medication. Okay, all right. Nobody was like, darn it. Yeah, like, I disagree with you. People who are, this is America, I deserve to live in a room full of knives and medications and loaded guns, right? In the event that you're in crisis, limiting access to lethal means is good because we know, based on the data, there's somebody, yes?
Maybe I'll brand myself the proverbial turd in the punch bowl, but why is it, if we believe that people have self-ownership, that we automatically, and I don't mean it's a bad thing generally, but why do we automatically assume that they don't have a right to end their own lives or that they need to be interfered with? Why do we automatically assume that?
That's an interesting question. I think from a philosophical angle, like, you do own your own life, and what you choose to do with it, I think, is up to you. But in the giant majority of cases in which we've seen people who have survived a suicide attempt, the colossal, like 90% of them don't go on to kill themselves later. Right? There was
That's an honest answer.
Yeah, and I would like to elaborate a little bit further on that too, if I have time. They did a study of people who had survived jumping off of the Golden Gate Bridge specifically. And literally everybody that they surveyed who had survived jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, all of them, 100%, said as soon as they jumped off, they regretted everything and realized that all the problems in their life were solvable. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Lunesta. First, I'm terribly sorry to hear about both of your friends. And I will say that medication does have a big role in this. Sometimes it's as prosaic as somebody was down on sleep aid and that negatively affected their mental health to the point where they became suicidal in a large number of cases. I mean, everyone's heard of the opiate crisis that's going on. I think these are related. I think there's strong evidence to say that if you don't have coping abilities, people will turn to things like alcohol and drugs to try and help. So there's a high degree of overlap. A lot of medications make things worse. They really do. In talking with one of my colleagues, Dr. Jeff Sung, who's a past president of the State Psychiatric Association up in Washington, and a key member of our task force, he pointed out that for the youth specifically, this is people, I believe, under the age of 20, I could be mistaken, but for youth, the prescription drugs that are prescribed as antidepressants increase significantly suicide risk, especially in young people. For people who are like sort of middle of the pack in age, there's no meaningful statistical effect. And then there's some degree of benefit for people who are, I believe, over the age of 50. But in certain populations, certain medications will definitely make things worse. It's hard to tell. The joke is if you're taking Benadryl, you could potentially wind up suicidal but die with clear sinuses. And because I have a dark sense of humor, I laugh at that. And I'm heartened to see that everybody else is doing so as well, at least enough of you that I don't feel super awkward about it. The easiest way to sort of parse that, again, I am a layperson, would be behavioral changes. So if somebody starts taking a medication of some sort and things that they used to do they stop doing, they start doing different things, there's a significant behavioral change. Significant behavioral change is in and of itself a strong indicator that somebody might be suicidal. So we can only observe the things that we can observe. And so in some cases, there are no visible warning signs. And we can do the best that we can, and this is the best that we have right now, but it's not a guarantee. And in terms of like the broader answer to your question about like how do medications affect people, a lot of that's going to be case-by-case basis. So, yes, sir, you got a question as well? That is an excellent question. So the question specifically is, what is the line between somebody with a dark sense of humor and somebody who may actually be suicidal? And this is a veteran-specific training. And as a result, we have to be cognizant of the fact that a lot of people who have done much more interesting things in the armed forces than I have, I'm a total pogue, I'm not a cool guy, I never kicked any doors or anything, right? Many of us who have served in the armed forces develop a distinctive gallows humor. And again, if that's a normal baseline for somebody and suddenly it changes, again, significant changes from baseline is what we're really looking for. So, from their baseline, yes, that's correct. Yes. Yes, ma'am. I would certainly hope that the people, so she points out the fact, say again? Yeah. So basically she said she's studying to be a mortician. And as a result, most of her humor involves death in some flavor or another. And she's concerned, will she be targeted by people who don't understand her sense of humor? My response is, I would certainly hope that the people that know you best understand that this is something you're learning how to do. And as a result, that's who you are as a person. So the best thing is person-to-person counseling. Like, us being able to help each other is kind of the big moral of the story that we're getting at here. So I would certainly hope that, I'm assuming you guys know each other reasonably well. Okay, I would assume that you would know her well enough to understand this is a normal behavior for her. So, excellent. Did I see another hand go up? Yes, sir. Yes. I would assume that you would know that better than I would. So the question was, if you're asking somebody, are you thinking about suicide, are you thinking about killing yourself, should you also ask that person, are you thinking about killing other people? And my response is, the totality of circumstances are going to inform your decision on that. If you know the person well, because again, this is peer-to-peer stuff. You're talking to people that you know to a degree, right? And you're like, this guy kind of smells like a school shooter. If that stands out to you as something you should be worried about, then you should ask. But if it doesn't, then you shouldn't. Yeah, so the comment was essentially that red flag things about people coming to seize firearms and whatnot, the police wouldn't necessarily be knowledgeable about you. And what we've seen, at least in Washington State, now granted, there are so many different versions of how these statutes are written. The way they are in Washington State, it's not the best, it's not the worst. The more I learn about these things, the more I realize I'm not qualified to talk about them. Because they're very complex. And so one of the key members of our task force is on the King County Prosecutor's Office, and she is a subject matter expert in this. But essentially, they're in Washington State. Again, I can't speak to other jurisdictions. I apologize. The two types of people that can instigate a extreme risk protection order are either a direct family member, who presumably probably wouldn't, and we can actually see based on empirical data in our state, it's very rare that family members do this, again, because we know each other better, right? Or a law enforcement agency. So if a person petitions a law enforcement agency for a protective order along these lines, it then has to go through various types of legal review. I think it goes about 6 layers of review in our state before a judge can actually act on it. Hopefully through that process, the totality of circumstances can best be understood, but you do have an appeals process too. So without knowing how all of those different ERPOs or red flag statutes work in other jurisdictions, it's challenging for me to comment more broadly. But you do get your day in court in Washington, and your family is 50% of the people that can actually potentially have one, and it doesn't happen that way very often. So it's not a satisfying answer because I got one state out of 50, but it's the best I can do. So I do want to move back onto the presentation we got. I'm on TV. Look at that. So this is sort of the follow-on thing. We're getting to the R step about reducing access to lethal means. So in the event that somebody is in crisis, in many jurisdictions, we've run into problems with the criminalization of private firearm transfers, Washington being one of those. In 2014, by ballot initiative 594, 59% of the electorate said that we should make it illegal for private citizens to be able to transfer firearms amongst each other. The unintended consequence from this was that the clinical best practice for treating a suicidal patient with access to firearms is, hey, maybe you should have somebody else hold on to your guns while you're suicidal. And we made that illegal. So my organization went to the state legislature and said, this is an unreasonable standard. This needs to get fixed. So we basically took the National Rifle Association and the Alliance for Gun Responsibility and locked them in a room and said, figure it out. And they did. So in 2017, in a beautiful moment of rare bipartisanship, we amended our firearm transfer statutes so that as long as it's a temporary transfer, you don't use the other person's gun and prevent self-harm, you're empowered by the law to do the right thing at the right time for the right reasons. You cannot be held criminally liable for that. Thank you. So there are some jurisdictions in which that amendment or exemption has not been made statutory. I was talking to somebody who works in a law firm in California along these lines. Yes, of course, it's California. And there are other jurisdictions that also have, air quotes, universal background check statutes that do not include a exemption for suicide prevention. And I would encourage you to talk to the suicide prevention organizations in your local states about that specific issue. Because, again, suicide prevention has to be a gun rights issue. You can't talk about one without the other. And this is an area where there is definitely common ground. So you can hold on to somebody else's guns. If you don't trust yourself with your own guns, feel empowered, have somebody else hold on to them for you. Even our president, Abraham Lincoln, at one point his friends were concerned about him. Abraham Lincoln struggled with mental health for a large chunk of his years. And his friends at one point held on to all of his pistols, knives, and dirks, because I guess dirks were very popular at the time, until he was no longer in crisis. And if you don't think Abraham Lincoln is a worthwhile role model, then I don't know if we can be in the same room together, right? Because he's also a tall, gangly guy like me, or he was anyway, right? And I like to think that I'm tall and gangly. Yes, sir. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, so the comment was that in the state of Colorado, a coalition of various groups over there has put together an interactive map that people can use to look up locations where they can temporarily store firearms in a crisis, which is awesome. It includes gun ranges, local police agencies. Not every police agency has the ability for various logistical reasons to hold on to firearms temporarily, but some do. Is that something that we were aware of? We were aware of it. We weren't directly causal to it. So the people that were putting that together are folks that we've coordinated with in the past. We think it's great. And if I had greater bandwidth, because I'm kind of a one-man band for my program, it's definitely something I'd love to do in Washington State as well. But I do this whole program solo. So as soon as I have the time, I'd love to work on some policy along those lines. I think it's a great idea. I love that they've done it. So I believe there's a hand. Yes, sir. There you go. So he pointed out that there was a situation which removing firearms from one of his relatives could have been possibly more contentious than it was worth. So when he left the home, he discreetly removed the firing pins from all of his firearms. So I love the fact that you took proactive steps. Right? You saw there was a problem and you decided to do something about it. And I love that. That's great. One of the other solutions that we've had some people talk about is like a lot of people, particularly veterans, and again, this is a veteran-centric training, have a very strong personal connection to firearms. It's part of their identity. If you're familiar with the Rifleman's Creed, there was a point in my junior enlisted life at which I could recite the entire thing from memory. One-time Lance Corporal Bass could have done that, but recently separated Sergeant Bass really doesn't anymore. But I can tell you it starts with, this is my rifle, there are many like it, but this one is mine. Right? And so there is a strong personal sense of identity that goes along with being entrusted by your community, by your republic, to bear arms in its defense. Many people are simply not willing to separate themselves from that completely. And so we've had several cases in which people have said, like, I know I shouldn't have access to it while I'm in crisis, but I just can't bring myself to get rid of it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a gun safe and I'm going to give my keys to my wife. So the firearms are still technically there. They just don't necessarily have access. So there are different things that you can do. The big thing I want to emphasize, though, because we're all kind of on the same sheet of music about firearm storage, and we can tell that empirically, too. The surveys that you guys are doing, these guys, we can tell by looking at this that the huge majority of people that own firearms are very responsible about how they're stored. So, like, good for you guys. Good for us, right? The area where people just are not putting conscious thought into this is medications. I think that even though we have, like, a really small uptick in the rate with which people securely store medications, it's not statistically significant. People just don't think about it. And there's a strange amount of hyper-attention to this in like very rural communities, whereas there seems to be very low attention paid to it in urban centers. I don't know, that's anecdotal based on just my personal experiences with my program. But broadly speaking, does anybody here lock up their meds? Oh, not every day. At least three or four of you. That's more than I was expecting, frankly. So good for you guys. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, it's great. The comment was that there are many jurisdictions in which local police or sheriff's agencies will have a disposal system for unused or unwanted medication, so you can simply bring them there and with no questions asked dispose of everything. Although it was pointed out wisely that if you're just taking the whole prescription bottle, it has like your name and social security number, address, list of deepest fears and favorite colors, maybe remove that because you don't want random people getting that information. If you guys are curious, if you don't know about programs in your local jurisdictions that do that, maybe if you don't have one where you live, one of the things that I have for free is a medication disposal pouch. So if you have unused meds and you want to get rid of them, don't just flush them down the toilet. They'll wind up in the water table. We don't want that. You tear the pouch open, you pour your pills in, you add water, and you throw it away. Doesn't wind up doing anything weird to the fish. It's all good. And again, I have a bunch of these. Please take as many as I have. It'll cost us less money to ship everything back to Washington State. So I have these available. So it's very simple. So to use this, you tear this pouch open. It's got sort of weird sandy-like substance in it. You pour your medication, be it a liquid or pills, into the baggie. Pour water in, seal it, shake the bag up, and throw it in the trash. Simple. Right? Yes, sir? Nice. The WHO, you said? Walgreens. Okay, I misheard you. So Walgreens apparently has a system by which you can also dispose of medications, much like the law enforcement option was pointed out, which is great. Great. Comment was they're doing it in Chicago, and that's good. It's something that is probably more common than I would have initially thought. So, yes, sir. I'm really glad that you asked this. The question was, are there cases in which people initially cooperate? And they're like, yeah, you're right, I shouldn't be around, you know, all these potentially lethal things. And then after the fact, they will circumvent that to then gain access to the same equipment. Is that the question?
Yes.
Great. So most likely, probably. But it is very rare, I will say, that people will substitute a different means. It's very rare. Again, one of the things that, Dr. Jeff Sung loves to describe, that suicide is often like a hypnotic state. And when people put a plan together, if the plan is disrupted, very rarely will they substitute something else. And this is a pernicious line of thought that is uniquely common to our community, is that, well, if they don't have a fill-in-the-blank, they'll just use a whatchamacallit. And that's just not true. It just isn't true, right? There was a study done a few years back that he loves to point out, and the question that was posed was, hypothetically, somebody wants to jump off a bridge. If there's a barrier to prevent you from jumping off the bridge, what are the odds that person just finds a different way to kill themselves? Right? And for gun owners, gun ownership, individual personal firearms ownership, was the demographic indicator that showed by like 40%, gun owners said 100% of the time that guy's going to do something else. No other demographic was even remotely close to that. Not age, sex, nationality, economic status. The key indicator of the idea that somebody will substitute different means is personal firearms ownership. And this is bizarre to me. So in the event that you secure access to all these things on the list, and in crisis, maybe they had the plan where they're going to hang themselves with a specific rope and they don't have access to that rope again, very, very rarely will they substitute something else. So the question was, in the event somebody chooses to kill themselves, is not self-inflicted gunshot like the most terrible and violent way to do it? And if somebody were willing to do that, would they not also be willing to, for example, take a handful of sleeping pills and quietly go off to sleep? The answer statistically is no. It just doesn't bear itself out. And the other thing is self-inflicted gunshot is fatal like 80, 90% of the time. Whereas if you down that bottle of sleeping pills, for example, typically what happens is you regain consciousness in agonizing pain, and then for several hours until your stomach can get pumped, you're in agonizing pain. Tylenol, for example. If you down an entire bottle of Tylenol, the damage it will inflict upon your internal organs is irreversible. And medication overdose is extremely painful for the majority of people that do it, except for people that know specifically how to administer medications in a way that's highly fatal. Your hand is up very emphatically. So, yeah. So the comment was, even if logically somebody said shooting myself is violent, terrible, and as a result I'm also going to do that, people who are suicidal are not logically thinking. It's almost like a hypnotic state. Yes, sir. It's a great question. So the question was, in the cases where people attempt killing themselves and then they don't die, the example I used earlier about the Golden Gate Bridge, where literally everyone who survived jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge decided they wanted to live and everything was solvable, does that same sort of mental effect take place for securing access to potentially lethal means? I don't know. I don't have data on that. But I will say that in the event that even, let's hypothetically say that somebody had to substitute a less lethal means. Right. Let's say that somebody has a Remington 870 loaded with double-aught buckshot, and they're planning on shooting themselves with it. And now they no longer have the Remington 870. And instead, they have to choose literally anything else. The odds of them surviving go way up. I don't necessarily know that this is going to be a magic one-shot stop. Like, hey, I'm really worried about you. Can I hold on to your gun so you're out of crisis? For some people, that may be like, oh man, I need to fix my life. I need to talk to a counselor. For some people, it may not. But I will say that reducing access to lethal means in times of crisis significantly improves survival odds. If you look at overall suicide fatality, it's like 50.1%, just barely over half of all suicides are from self-inflicted gunshot. Like, a huge majority of attempts are done with medication. And that's why we talk about locking up firearms, which we're already doing a very good job at. But we're really pushing the medication angle, too. Because if we can have somebody, even if they do substitute, which, again, doesn't happen very often, it's very rare, but even if they did substitute something that was less lethal, they're much more likely to survive. So, yes, ma'am? Probably yes. I'll give you my business card. The question was, is there a way to get a copy of the slides for those that couldn't attend? And I will make it happen. Yes, ma'am? Yes, ma'am? The question is, do people who've had their firearms confiscated or hold on by somebody else then go on to attempt suicide by cop? I don't know. I don't have data on that specific point. So I don't want to say one way or the other, because I honestly don't know. It would surprise me. It would surprise me. But, yes, sir? There's a large percentage of people who wind up taking their own lives have been hospitalized within 6 months prior to. And it's for... hospitalized. So any sort of like physical injury, because people who are physically injured often wind up being victim of more stress further on. So it could be both, but there is a much larger correlation than I thought between physical well-being and mental well-being, which is one of the reasons why exercise is generally good for people. But in the event you wind up injured, that also does negatively affect your mental state as well as your physical self. So I don't know if there's a specific injury. I don't know of one. If there is one, I don't know of it. Yeah, anything that winds up physically impairing you, because in the event you wind up physically injured, maybe you can't go back to work. If your self-identity is tied up in your ability to perform a specific job you can no longer do, that affects you. Maybe that negatively affects the relationship you have with other people, et cetera, and it can be one more thing to add to the stack. I've got... two more, and we're going to go with you, sir, and then you, sir.
Real quick, I'll just ask something.
Yeah, okay.
That's kind of a gray area where
so the question was, what about people who use the threat of suicide in order to manipulate others, in order to glean sympathy? I think there's a term for this, and it's narcissists. So how common is it? I don't know. I do know that there are people out there that do this, that will attempt to feign some sort of mental health thing in order to then glean sympathy, reach concessions, et cetera. Some people try to, like, bully their way out of a divorce, for example. Like, oh, if you leave me, I couldn't possibly go on leave. It's hard to offend me. I spent 13 years in the Marines. That does, because this is a topic that's near and dear to me. I'm operating the assumption that I'm training how to deal with a well-adjusted person who is not acting with malice. So as for how common, again, I don't know. Yes, sir. Yes, we probably ought to. The question was, can we have a separate time for questions at the end of the presentation and finish first? Yes, we can. We feel pretty good about that. Oh, we got one exception. You'll be the very last one. Yeah, the comment was that people you try to help by, for example, holding onto their firearms for them in times of crisis, in many cases, can be glad that you showed enough empathy to care. That's what we like to think anyway. I mean, I've had to do this for three of my friends on three separate occasions. We have to move on. We'll do questions at the end. I promise we'll get to you. The comment was essentially was that even if that person has decided they want to do it, again, they're not thinking clearly, and it leaves an enormous amount of pain for everybody else. So definitely yes. So move to the next slide, please. We will try to wrap this up as rapidly as possible. We've kind of already covered this. We can go to the next one. So next steps of care. We're all lay people here. Actually, is anybody here like a clinician or a provider? There are actually a couple. So most of us are lay people. We have some providers. And, of course, for you, we have slightly different roles, responsibilities, et cetera. For the rest of us, we're just regular people, and we're trying to help the people we care about. As a community, as a family, as friends, if you've got buddies you go shoot IDPA with or something, get to know them. Make sure that you're doing okay. But if you have to refer them to somebody else, we'd like to be able to do so. So you go to the next slide. We've got some recommendations here. That's the big one right there. And if you guys want to get your phones out and save the crisis line number into your phone literally right now, you will not offend me. And also the Learn card, that little yellow card I passed out, has the crisis hotline number on at the bottom. I have a very early version of this card in my wallet at all times. And to prove it to you, I will present it right now. I would recommend that you do the same thing, right? I always have this with me. And if there's someone I'm dealing with and I'm no longer comfortable helping because I'm out of my depth, because I'm just a regular person too, I have at least one resource I can physically give to them, be like, hey, let's call this number together and we'll try to get you connected to somebody who's a specialist in this, right? So I'd encourage you to do that. You can also text 741-741. There are geographic codes that go along with it in Washington. So if you text the word HEAL, it will let them know that you're in the Pacific Northwest. But you can text anything to it, and they'll connect you to somebody. If you are a prior service person, you can hit 1 for veteran services. It's the same type of services, but you'll be connected to somebody who either is a veteran themselves or is no more than 1 degree of separation removed, such as brother, spouse, etc. So, boom. Move to the next slide, please. Here we have some more veteran-specific organizations. There's a tremendous amount of energy behind preventing veteran suicide. Mission 22 was founded a few years back because of, at that time, there were 22 veterans a day that were ending their own lives. We're down between 20 and 17 at this point, so I hope they don't feel the compelling need to change the name, but it's nice that they would have the opportunity to do so if they chose to. But Give an Hour is an excellent resource. If you can't afford to go to a therapist, Give an Hour is a way that you can talk to a licensed mental health professional for an hour at no cost. It's only for an hour, but you can call them and you can talk to a professional and it doesn't cost money, which is, they're spectacular. The bottom one there, the Irreverent Warriors. If you're familiar with Donnie O'Malley, irreverent is definitely the right term. A lot of their YouTube content is not appropriate for a public setting in which young people might observe it, but it's very true to like the veteran community, especially those of us that have served in Iraq or Afghanistan, like in my case. But they have a big thing called the Silkies Hike. Are you familiar with Silkies? Okay, so for those of you not, I'm wearing shorts right now, and if you can imagine shorts that basically end at like a really inappropriate, like short level, these are issued in the Marine Corps, and they've sort of taken on a weird sort of personality of their own. So the idea is you get together with a bunch of your buddies who are separated from the armed forces. If you're still in, that's cool too, but you wear silkies, you carry a 22 kilogram pack, and you march for 22 miles. And there's a lot of stopping for beer. And it's a lot of fun, and there's inappropriately short shorts, and it's kind of funny. But it's a great way to sort of build camaraderie and whatnot. So, again, this is a presentation geared toward veteran community, so we have some more veteran-specific resources there. So we can move to the next slide. We're just about wrapped up here. So the things that you can do today, first, that one there says died by suicide. One of the things I didn't say at any point was committed suicide. Right? I got a huge thumbs up from you. I appreciate you, sir. Remember, people don't commit heart disease. People don't commit lung cancer. People don't commit being shot by somebody else. People die from these things. And so, again, going back to my idea about technically accurate and respectful terminology, we say died by suicide within the field of suicide prevention. I would encourage you to do so as well, to be more technically accurate about everything. You got the Learn card. Keep that with you if you wind up needing to help somebody. The cool thing about the 800 number, the crisis hotline, you don't have to be in imminent crisis to call them. So if you're worried about somebody but maybe they're not imminently suicidal at that moment, unlike calling 911. You can be like, hey, we just want to see how the system works. Don't do that with 911. It will not go well for you. But with a crisis hotline, hey, I'm with Fred here, and Fred's having a hard time. He's not suicidal right now, but we just want to go through the motions so we can see what it looked like. They're totally cool with that. The last bit I'd have, put a plan together. I mentioned the plan earlier. Get to know the people that you go shooting with. of course, within your own family units, like make sure you guys have some sort of plan in place. You've probably heard some version of the adage before, failure to plan is planning to fail. And this is an area where we cannot afford to fail. Again, we've done a tremendous job of reducing negligent firearm mishaps. At least in Washington State, you can make an argument we've reduced it by 90% in the last 40, 50 years. That's huge. We did that as a community without significant legislation. We didn't have anything confiscated. We did that by instituting standards of behavior. Like Colonel Cooper's 4 universal rules of safe firearms handling. You guys know those, right? Can I please have a show of hands to show me who knows those rules? Whole bunch of you guys. I got started in this line of work because I wound up representing the firearms industry at a panel for King County. And it was a room full of public health folks. And I said, this is a serious problem. How many of you guys actually own a gun? 2 hands go up. There's 400 people at the conference. How many of you guys can tell me the 4 universal rules of safe firearms handling? 1 hand goes up. Like, this is a serious problem. You guys are way ahead of the power curve, right? Knowing what to do and being able to put those plans together, we can have really meaningful changes. We have to, right? That's what I've got. I have one last slide which should have the evaluation. My superiors would love it if you guys could evaluate the presentation there. Don't tell them how bad my jokes were, because I don't think they appreciate just how groan-inducing they are. Is there one more slide? It? You're kidding me. What's that? It's not. No. Well, shucks, you guys. There's no evaluation slide for this. That's going to be frustrating. But I'll tell you what. Yes, sir? That's a great point. He says there's no one that's too young. He was dealing with a 4th grader, a student resource officer who was considering suicide. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I've got for you guys. I apologize. The slide presentation was not perfect. We try to do the best we can. But the good news is there isn't an evaluation. So you guys have your paperwork here, correct? Okay. If you want to get gear for me, what we're going to do is head over to that table, little black table over in the corner. I have about 40 pistol safes, and I've got about 16 shotguns, 16 rifle, a whole case of medication stuff. If you want gear, I just need to get your paperwork there. If you'd be kind enough to keep both documents together and simply fold them in half so that nobody can see your contact information. But I do need to have them both together, and I will get you your gear. I do not know. I will be doing that my own self later. Thank you.